This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It is Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Day. We'll check in with reporters here in Northwest Indiana Media to find out about the big stories of the week. We'll have Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana. We'll also have Bob Casarda with the Times, who works out of the Valparaiso newsroom. Joe Pete from the Times, the business reporter, will be joining us to talk about stories. And we'll have John Gard from the Michigan City and LaPorte newspapers on the air to talk about stories from LaPorte County. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's turn first to Dan Carton, who is the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And he's calling, we're talking to him from his office in Indianapolis. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, tell us, we know now that, of course, there's going to be a fuel tax increase for those of us who drive on the roads, and for folks who own airplanes that fly, they're going to face an increase in their fuel taxes too. But there are several other taxes, in fact, several dozen other taxes, I guess, that you outline in a bit more detail in your story a few days ago in the Times that Hoosiers will be paying, and all of it, of course, takes effect on July 1st. Tell us about them.
Yeah, by my count, we got 45 different tax and fee increases that were approved this year by the Republican-controlled General Assembly, Republican Governor Eric Holcomb. Like you said, the fuel tax increase is probably going to be the most noticeable. That hits on July 1st. It'll be 10 cents a gallon, and that money will go towards rebuilding the state's roads, which is something a lot of people have said that Indiana needs to do, and Republicans in the State House said their polling showed that Hoosiers support a tax increase if they were assured the money is only going to roads, and in this case, that's what it's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other ones take effect in future years or later on. For example, in 2018, there'll be a new $15 registration fee to support local road projects. So when you renew your license plates next year, you'll pay an extra $15. So the street in front of your house might get repaved sooner rather than later. So, but really, the rest of them, I mean, they run the gamut from, you know, college students are now going to have to get a mandatory meningitis vaccine, which can be $150 if you don't have insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Public or school teachers will have to get another background check. They get one now when they're hired, but now they're going to have to get one every 5 years just to make sure that the schools aren't employing, you know, people who've racked up felonies without their employer noticing. And it's just a bunch of fees up and down. You know, some people will pay them, some people won't. But the issue that some people have been speaking to me about is sort of the hypocrisy of the Republican Party. Their platform opposes tax increases. They just jacked up a bunch of taxes. You know, the people who support them said, you know, this is what we need to do. We need to pay for what we're getting, the services we're getting. We don't want to become Illinois, mm-hmm. where, you know, you have a lot of government services and it's just, well, they don't even have a budget, so.
I noticed that you mentioned in the article about the fact that it's, and some fees that are going to go up are ones that are, I guess, going to happen specifically for people that do specific actions. Like, example, if you happen to go to court, either file some papers or some papers filed, I guess, against you, whoever files the papers will have to pay a bit more. But that's a fee that basically is pretty specialized, is it not?
It is. Yeah, it's the service of process fee is going to go from $25 to $28. And there are some other specific fees in here. Decatur County wants a new jail, so the legislature authorized a special income tax of up to 0.65% for people in Decatur County, assuming that the county council approves that. So, you know, not every Hoosier is going to pay every fee, but, you know, if you file a court document or you need to visit a notary or, you know, you buy gas, you get a license plate, you'll pay something.
One of the other things, too, I note in the article, and you mentioned, and you can, of course, you can always, if you want to do all the research, you can find out these things, too. But you're finding more occupations now, and you talked a little bit here in particular about teachers having to pass background checks, and the fees that they have to pay for those background checks are going to go up. But you noted there's some more, it seems to be more Indiana occupations that are being regulated these days, and obviously those are involving licenses of some type or the other, and we're going to see some increases in the cost of those, too, I imagine.
Yeah, Governor Pence actually was trying to lead an effort to get away from occupational regulation, and actually created this thing called the Job Creation Committee that spent 2 or 3 years looking at all of the regulated occupations for ones to deregulate, and they didn't end up finding any because they seemed to discover that every regulated occupation has a reason why it's regulated. You don't want anybody off the street being a doctor or being a dentist, or even things like landscape architecture, where you know there is a public safety aspect to that. They decided to keep those regulated. So there are a few more new regulated occupations. Massage therapists previously could be endorsed, or I believe it wasn't a specific licensing, but there was a kind of an endorsement process from the state.
Mm-hmm.
There's some new regulations on social workers who come to Indiana from other states can get their license faster if they pay a fee. So, there's a few more regulated occupations happening.
And we see, of course, we'll have the usual ones that we always know about, cosmetologists, barbers, hairdressers, that sort of thing.
Right.
They've always been licensed of some type, you know, because of the fact that you've got public safety involved there, too. And it's probably just as well, too, because that's an important aspect of public life and public occupations, to be sure. So what seems to be the reaction, though, we say, you know, with the Republican administration, many of the lawmakers approving the increases, of course, without much complaint, and especially when after the debate concerning the highway work and the bills that have came up in this past session. What do the Democrats have to say about all these?
Yeah, well, and the issue is the Democrats voted for a lot of these. A lot of these passed, you know, overwhelmingly. There's very few party-line votes at the State House. There were Democrats who voted for the road funding increase. There were mm-hmm. Democrats who voted for the state budget, which had some of these taxes in it. So it's their hands aren't spotless on this and saying, oh, no, we oppose to all the taxes. The most response I've gotten are from Republicans who truly do oppose all tax increases and say taxes should never be raised. And they're saying, yeah, we need more pure Republicans in the State House who believe that taxes should never go up and stuff like this wouldn't happen, that they're suggesting that the party's sort of gone soft because they control everything, so they're, you know, just sort of administering the state rather than, you know, transforming the state to be the kind of state that they want.
Well, I guess we'll probably see if anything of that comes about at the next elections here, I guess, if the right candidates make it onto the ballot and campaign and actually get elected to see any of these changes take place like you talk about here, the ones that are more hardline Republicans.
Right. And, because so many districts aren't very competitive in Indiana, it'll be a primary fight within the Republican Party of, you know, which direction does it want to go in. You know, Eric Holcomb isn't the same kind of governor as Mike Pence, so you're already starting to see things that wouldn't have been acceptable last year being signed into law this year.
We're talking with Dan Carton, who is, of course, the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. I was looking, we've been talking here about courts and other expenses that are increasing here, too. And one note here you make mention in another story, too, talks about the Indiana Department of Revenue and how they're making some changes out of Indianapolis, and which I'm sure will affect all of the state, and making it easier and making it a little faster to do business with the state. Tell us about your story there.
Yeah. The Indiana Department of Revenue has been sort of struggling with some old technology for the last few years, maybe the last decade. If you remember a few years ago, they found like $100 million that had been accumulating in an account that people didn't even realize was there, just because they weren't able to visualize all their accounts in one place. So the General Assembly this year approved spending $33 million to upgrade the technology at the Department of Revenue. And this, they believe, will ultimately produce more revenue for the state because they think the department hasn't been as effective at ensuring that everybody is paying what they owe simply because they don't have the the tools that they need to do it. What's interesting and what I wrote about is the new commissioner, Adam Krupp, who's from Plymouth, Indiana, which is sort of just southeast of LaPorte. He's working on that, of course, but he's also stressing customer service. He wants the Department of Revenue to be your friendly neighborhood tax collector rather than the guy knocking on your door coming to take all your money, which some have suggested that the department has played that role in the past.
It'll be interesting to see what happens here, and especially if these expensive improvements that the state is having to do here, and no doubt in many cases well-deserving improvements, especially to IT and the like, make a difference, I suppose, too. One of the other stories, too, Dan, that you covered and we've been able to see online as well as in print, been talking about a couple school districts where teachers are being able to pick up some interesting bonuses. Tell us about the Hammond teachers and the Lake Ridge teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. Indiana has a program that provides $2 million in bonuses statewide to educators who teach in what are known as Title I schools. Those are schools that have a lot of children that come from low-income families. The idea is to, reward teachers who are probably working with some of the most difficult students in the state, give them incentives to stay at those schools rather than jumping to a much nicer school or a easier school to work at. And the State Department of Education has a competitive process for awarding these grants. And students or teachers in the school, highly ranked teachers in the school city of Hammond, mm-hmm. are going to get about $500,000 to split among themselves, or to be split by the administration or the school board, I'm assuming.
Right.
And then another $16,000 will go to teachers at Hosford Park New Tech Elementary School in the Lake Ridge School District.
I've heard about that school. That's in the same area that I happen to live in, too. So I hear a lot of good things about the teachers working in the Lake Ridge School District and some of the problems they run into, and they've managed to do pretty well, too. So it's great that these teachers are going to get bonuses. Now, is it the case where maybe some other school districts in Northwest Indiana might be eligible for the same type of bonuses, too, because of the makeup of their districts?
They would. It's like I said, it's a competitive application process that the Department of Education does every year, and Hammond and Lake Ridge were selected this year based on teacher performance, and they use a measurement of student career readiness. And so that's who got it this year. But there's also a separate bonus program for every teacher in the state called Teacher Appreciation Grants. The state, the legislature appropriated $30 million this year to reward the best teachers all across Indiana. So those usually go out November, December, so we should know later in the year, where the best teachers are and how much they're getting for doing their job.
That's great. That's great. Let's hope we pick up some more awards here for teachers here in Northwest Indiana from that. It'll be great to find that out later, too. We've been talking with Dan Carton, who is a State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Dan, thank you very much for the stories that you've worked on and for the information on them. We appreciate it. We'll check back in with you sometime soon again. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thanks.
You're listening to Reporters Roundtable here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to news in LaPorte County, and for that we're going to turn to John Gard. He's a reporter who writes for not only the LaPorte Herald Argus, but also the Michigan City News Dispatch. John, thanks for joining us once again here on the program.
Hi, Chris. Nice to talk with you.
Some interesting stories here, and this week have come out of the LaPorte County government, and one in particular I think that let's talk first here about is, I guess, the issues involving the fairgrounds and an interesting loan that is being forgiven, and also some demands to kind of do an upchange in the management in that operation. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it started out as a request to forgive a loan from the county. The county had loaned the LaPorte County Agricultural Association $250,000 back in 2012, and this nonprofit organization was having difficulty making payments. It was to be a 25-year loan for $10,000 a year, and so they had asked that the county forgive that loan, which at first might seem unreasonable, but the loan was for a sewer line that was installed at the fairgrounds, and the Agricultural Association is in charge of managing the fairgrounds, including the annual fair, which is coming up next month, and it was having difficulty. It's run into financial straits and was having difficulty making payments on the loan. So the county agreed to forgive the loan. And in addition to that, it took the opportunity to restructure the whole arrangement, management of the fairgrounds. So the Agricultural Association, which has been involved with the supporting the fair for since 1845 or something, for a long time ago, will still be involved, but there'll be a new nonprofit organization created specifically to manage the fairgrounds, including the fair and a number of other events that that go on there throughout the year.
Have you been aware, or is it pretty common knowledge about problems that have happened there at the LaPorte County Fairgrounds? Since it's such a long-standing facility, we mentioned, you know, going back to the 1800s, so obviously over the years they've made improvements, but are they having problems in trying to keep the buildings up, and in turn that's why they needed the loan?
No, actually, the fairgrounds seems to be operating just fine, and they put on a fine fair every year.
That's what I understand,
It's a huge event here in LaPorte County. The whole county shuts down for a week as for the fair. But it seems to be run just fine. I don't think there are any complaints about that. But I think there was some reconsideration of this arrangement that was made back in 2012, where because it's a county-owned property and this nonprofit group was asked to make improvements in the site, and that just didn't sit well with some folks, and because it was a fairly burdensome debt for this nonprofit group, and it turns out the county has also used the sewer line for things besides the fairgrounds. It's since extended it to the community corrections facility out there, and has used it for other publicly owned sites. So. It's a rethinking of that whole arrangement is how it turns out.
I can understand that. Like you say, if it has gone out further than its original intended location from the fairgrounds itself, that I guess it's only fair that that others should share in the responsibility as well as in the expense of dealing with that line. So that's something we'll watch here, and of course watch for whenever the LaPorte County Fair is coming up soon and see how they're doing as well, too. One of the other stories that you offered us this week talks about how the LaPorte County planners have come up with a way to kind of improve the code enforcement activities in the county. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, there was a meeting last night, as a matter of fact, where the county commissioners voted to scale back this code ordinance. It's a county code enforcement ordinance, which is not unusual, except that it... people were fairly upset with the notion that they thought it might be a little bit too, as they called it, a government overreach, where they would have a code enforcement officer come out and tell people that their weeds are too high, or that, you know, they're going to have to get rid of the junk cars out of their yard or their abandoned vehicles out of their yard. And it also involved a noise ordinance or noise component. People turned out in droves. I think there were about 200 people over at the county complex last night for this meeting to voice objections to it. And as it turns out, the commissioners have voted to take out the weed and grass portion of the proposal and to take out the noise chapter of the ordinance. And so it'll have simply to do with junk on properties and things like that. So, and it'll go to the Plan Commission now and be revisited.
As far as you know, have these just been the major areas that the LaPorte County officials have been the most concerned about? They were concerned about the weeds and people not keeping their property up, and of course about the junk vehicles, trucks parked out in yards, and things like that.
Yes, absolutely. The commissioners, the president of the commission, Rich Mrzynski, says that the office gets about 1,000 complaints a year from county residents about these things, and they wanted an ordinance to help them enforce restrictions on those kinds of things. And it's not unusual. Porter County has a county code enforcement officer, most municipalities have a code enforcement officer, but out in the county, people argued on a couple of different levels, but they were concerned about the weed and grass portion. They thought, you know, well, I have 20 acres here. How can I keep that mowed all the time? It's mushy about half the time. So There were a lot of concerns about the ordinance, and it looks like their voices have been heard, and the ordinance is going to go back for a revision now, and we'll see what happens beyond that.
As we know, that's how the process works. You know, the ordinances or the laws are proposed, and if they have a chance to speak out, people will certainly do so. And that's what they did, as you say, last night in La Porte. Nice to hear. Another problem that you wrote stories on here for the newspapers this week involved U.S. 20. Tell us about the problems that the police say they were noting on that highway.
Yeah, well, the U.S. 20 in between about State Road 39 and State Road 2. On the north side of the county, has been an ongoing problem. There have been a number of wrecks, including two triple fatalities already this year, earlier this year. And so they undertook an enforcement action that involved an aircraft overhead and they call it line duty, where patrol officers line up along the highway. And if there are any violations, speeding or any other violations that appear to be from the air, that then folks will get pulled over, and they issued a number of citations in that regard. But the accidents continue along 20, and it's a bad spot, and the Indiana Department of Transportation is taking a look at what it can do to make that highway safer, which is, it's seen more traffic lately because of construction on the toll road. And a hike in toll rates, and so that little section of highway gets a lot more use than it used to.
I was going to ask you about that because there is that correlation there. That say when they start doing more work on the toll road, and they had stints of it here with last year, last couple 3 years or so, off and on in places, and this year again too. And then you said now we've got the tolls going up, which is some big jumps for some people for the first time, I think, since the toll road was privatized. So it's
right.
It's a lot of people surprised about that. So I can see why U.S. 20, it's certainly just a local road for most people, and it's a very, very, very busy local road at that, too. We can understand why the county is very concerned about it. When you talk about improvements that NDOT is wanting to make on U.S. 20, is there anything that you know of that's going to be planned here or is underway this summer or planned to be done this summer there?
Yes, the department has some plans to add rumble strips, I believe on the shoulder and in the center line. Mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of big highways like this, there's about an 18-inch center line that separates eastbound and westbound traffic. So there, it's thought that rumble strips will help. There's also plans for turn lanes this summer. In a couple of sections where the traffic is heavy and the old adage about left on and left off the highway is really dangerous, so they're going to add some turn lanes to try to alleviate some of that.
Well, this certainly sounds like some great improvements will be coming over time here on U.S. 20, to be sure. We've been talking with John Gard, who is a reporter for the La Porte Herald Argus, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch, covering news out of La Porte County Government. And we thank you very much, John, for being back with us again here on the program. And we'll be checking back in with you again soon on some other stories that you put out in the papers. We'll be looking forward for them. Thanks a lot today.
Thanks, Chris.
This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and now let's turn to Joseph Pete, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. He's in the newsroom over in Munster. And Joe, thank you for being with us today. You've got quite a few things on the business scene we want to talk about, and one in particular, which you have actually had a chance to actually break the story online and, of course, in the newspaper later, is the big news about what White Lodging Services is going to do with Star Plaza and not only the theater, which we've got a reprieve on from the last time it was told it was going to be torn down, but also the Twin Towers. Tell us what the folks at the White Lodging are planning to do, if they have been saying what they're going to be doing with that property now.
Oh, good to be here, Chris. Yes, they. We went through all this about 10 months ago, as many of my sources have noted. They had planned to demolish the Star Plaza, but kind of backed off after the death of Dean White, who had originally built it, along with the Twin Towers, completely transforming Merrillville and Hobart and that whole region into, you know, kind of a commercial and hotel mecca. They are now looking, they've been working on a plan to redevelop the site for some time. Originally, the plans were just calling for a hotel, possibly up to six stories, that was going to be, it would displace both the Star Plaza and the Radisson and Star Plaza, which is already well, the demolition of which is already well underway. And it was going to be surrounded by green space. They wanted to make it kind of a nice, more modern area. Currently, they're not, they're kind of still mum on what the plans are. They're still planning on building a hotel, but they're kind of eyeing something more ambitious for that site. They are saying it's going to take up the whole 30 acres, and they're going to intend it to be a legacy to the late billionaire Dean White. The specific details are not known, but it's not believed it'll include another music venue. Mm-hmm. So the Star Plaza Theater, after, you know, 40 years and countless A-list performers, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Bob Dylan, etc., it's going to be torn down next year after a final show by the Oak Ridge Boys. And then the Twin Towers, which are two of the largest buildings in Merrillville and in Northwest Indiana, will also be razed. They haven't been renewing leases there for some time. The commercial real estate industry kind of thought something was going to happen. I had asked about it, you know, several times, but this was the first I had finally heard something back from, you know, White Lodging. And then those are kind of, I don't know if they're iconic or landmark, but, you know, you can see them on I-65 from miles away. They're kind of, you know, kind of known as kind of part of the, along with the Centaur Building and the Chase Tower, kind of make up what the modest Merrillville skyline.
No, they're certainly not as tall. I should say the NIPSCO Nisource Building is not as tall as the Twin Towers, but it kind of goes along, too. It's some of that landscape notes that you just happen to pass on when I-65, when you're going through the areas, you get close to the U.S. 30 interchange. I was talking with Spiros Batistatos the other day, and he brought this up, too, about the impression that he got in talking with the folks at White Lodging was that apparently, and you talk about this legacy that the company wants to be able to do for the founder and putting up a different type of hotel facility. And he was giving me the impression that maybe with all that land available, this fits in about putting a more low-standing, low-key, maybe more of a luxury-style a hotel operation there so that you have bigger hotel rooms rather than lots of them.
Oh, yes. It's going to be much smaller than the current one. They're talking about only 220 rooms as compared to more under the 330. From what they've indicated, it's going to be kind of upscale. They are a large national company, White Lodging. They do have hotels all over the country. They operate with all pretty much the top luxury brands, like Aloft, Marriott, and so on. The long list of – they develop hotels for pretty much all the big hotel companies. This one is supposed to be kind of a higher-end one. It will have fewer rooms and less convention space. Some say that's kind of an adjustment to the market, but it would be like a full-service hotel, which is, you know, where they have the hotel, where it's going to have, you know, full restaurant, bars, all the amenities you get at a hotel in a big city. It should be nice, whatever it ends up being. They have talked about potentially bringing in a standalone restaurant as well to the site, but exactly what it's going to end up being remains to be seen. There is a people have said, you know, there is demand for such a facility in Northwest Indiana especially when companies like NIPSCO or whoever bring in out-of-town people for business, you know, they need somewhere nice to stay. And I'm sure whatever they build will end up replacing the Radisson at Star Plaza as kind of the central meeting space for Northwest Indiana. It hosted countless, like, Chamber of Commerce functions, business meetings. Anytime, you know, you had a senator or governor in town, they usually spoke in the ballrooms there.
Right.
You know, countless weddings. I'm sure whatever they build is going to kind of step up and fill that role.
And certainly it's not going to still take the place of what has already been talked about for some time. And we know now that that the county has turned over to the RDA that is looking at the feasibility of a standalone convention center.
Oh, yes.
That's under debate right now, too. I guess they're under review, maybe I should say. The RDA has turned over to its own person or organization to take a look at that.
Yes, they are studying that. From my understanding, I've done some reporting on that. From my understanding, they're looking at like multiple potential locations, not necessarily in Merrillville or Hobart, where everyone would just assume, but they were talking, you know, possibly the Lakeshore, Crown Point, you know, somewhere on U.S. 30, like the, you know, things that they're open to exploring all. But the scope of that study, I believe, is market feasibility to determine whether we'd even be able to, you know, support it, and if so, you know, where it should go and things of that nature. So that's open-ended. This certainly could include that, but I don't know what the government buy-in would be at this point.
Let me find out.
Yeah, it's still a blank canvas. I'm sure whatever it's going to be a pretty dramatic announcement when White Lodging is ready to unveil their plan.
We're all waiting for that, and we'll be looking forward to that. We're talking with Joseph Pete, who's a business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. One of the other stories that you've worked on here we want to talk on next is to talk about St. Joseph College and the efforts after the closing of the college here this school year, at the end of the school year. They want to try and reopen it again next year. Tell us what the thoughts are about that.
Yes, I don't know how just as a caveat, I don't know how feasible this is going to be, but there are definitely the alumni have not given up on it. They've never given up on it. They've put together a Phoenix, what they're calling like the Phoenix Committee, mm-hmm. where they're looking to re-engineer it so it's, you know, a lot smaller and more financially sustainable going forward. They face like serious financial challenges, though. They had $27 million in debt, $35 million in deferred maintenance on the aging buildings that they hadn't done anything about. But they're studying like how it can be, you know, because this was not a unique problem to St. Joseph College. There are a lot of small liberal arts schools across the country that have undergone similar financial challenges, but they're looking at kind of how they can reinvent it for a more modern age. I don't know what that's necessarily going to consist of, but they are aggressively, perhaps optimistically, looking at possibly reopening by August 2018. But there's no—I want to stress—there's no like concrete plan or anything. Mm-hmm. No one knows what this is going to look like at this point, and it's very difficult for colleges with only like 1,000 students to kind of exist in the modern education landscape. It's
going to be interesting to see, like you say, if they scale down the college itself and what type of facilities they're going to have there. They have this already allotted space on the entire campus. I'm sure they'll just have to figure out which buildings they're going to be able to use and for what purpose in the future and decide what to do with the rest, I suppose.
So some of it would possibly do with like what kind of education they offer. They mm-hmm. might, you know, lean more towards STEM as a result of this. It might be driven more kind of by, you know, market demands. It's really hard to say. From what they've said, you know, they're looking at kind of like an open-ended search, kind of pursuing like all, you know, potential solutions to how to, the key thing is it's a well-established institution. It's very well known. They have a very lovely campus. They don't want it to just, you know, fall into the ether of history. They want to, you know, keep it going in some form or fashion, even if it does end up looking radically different than what it did.
One of the other stories that you've covered for the Times this week, Joseph, was about a big announcement of a major investment in LaPorte. Tell us about how a company that's based out of the country is going to make a big investment, and in turn, dozens of people will be hired additional to the staff there in LaPorte.
Oh, yes. Renolit, they make high-quality plastics in LaPorte. It's a German-based company. They are eyeing a major investment of about $25 million into their facility there. They already employ about 175 people. It's they had acquired it. It was previously owned by the Solvay Group, and then it was one of those deals where they got it through an acquisition. But they're saying they've got like really strong demand from their existing customers, and then they're eyeing like more projects and more needs, and that they're potentially going to be expanding. They're expecting to expand. They're looking at hiring 30 more people, mostly in production, but that'll be like, that's still a couple years off. They were hesitant to kind of provide me with details about, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of workers and what kind of experience they'd be looking for, because they're not doing this hiring like right off the bat, but they do. It's a company, it's a pretty successful company with its fingers in a number of different industries. They do work for graphics, label, furniture, window profile industries. They've been a pretty good corporate citizen since they came into town. Over, you know, since about 2000, they've invested more than $100 million into LaPorte County. And, yeah, they're looking at kind of continuing their growth.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on that here and find out what announcements that come out of that. I understand, too, of course, and it's part of the procedure that always seems to go through, that the Indiana Economic Development Corporation offers up some conditional assistance financially based on how many new jobs that they happen to add. So we'll see if that actually comes about, too, I suppose, too. One of the other areas that you wrote a story on was dealing with a startup based in Valparaiso, and how this effort to start a business there has turned out to be a big award, at least the competition for a big award. They're moving quite a further along on this project. Now tell us about this company and the award that they've been seeking out.
Yes, it's a startup based in Valparaiso. King Tailgates, they're trying to kind of modernize the way people tailgate. They've devised like a patented seat for the back of a pickup truck, which is filled with all the kinds of modern day amenities. There's like a Bluetooth speaker, a USB outlet, making it easy to, like, you know, play music from your phone. There are cup holders, things of that nature. One of the guys has had back pain, and it was affecting his sports tailgating, so he came up with something that would be like more comfortable for people. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of Northwest Indiana. You know, when people think of business here, they often think of heavy industry, the steel mills, factories, oil refineries. But there are a lot of like smaller companies like this that people are starting in garages. We're often thought of the Rust Belt, but there are people devising like new iPhone cases, things like that. That there is this kind of this culture of innovation here a little bit, where people are trying to do something new. This particular company, they are currently they were named a semifinalist nationally in the SEMA's Launchpad competition in Las Vegas, which is an it looks for like innovation in the automotive accessories thing. It's a pretty big contest. Like, it's a lot of exposure for the winner, and that it can get them, you know, contacts with a lot of people in the industry where they might help them. This particular company, they're looking for someone to manufacture their product, and so that, you know, this is potentially pretty big deal for them. This is a pretty common strategy that a lot of these startups use. We have the Big Cell here in Hammond, which kind of serves a similar function. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the startups that come out of Hammond or come out of Purdue Northwest in particular, they'll often like look in these contests because it's a way to get attention from, you know, venture capitalists or other potential people who might finance your company, to get the attention of people who might manufacture your products. This is just all around. Even if you don't win, it's good exposure. It can potentially help you, you know, lift off your company or take it to the next level. And they're kind of hoping for the best. They're hoping they're get lucky out in Las Vegas.
Well, certainly, as you say, it's great publicity for them and for expansion in the future. And like you say, as well as opening up some doors, maybe in financing for it to be actually become a full-fledged business. I suppose that'd be interesting to see how that turns out, as well as the company and how they do in their competition. And finally, Joseph, you've had a story here that takes a look at the state of Indiana and the manufacturing picture. We know that we've seen some growth, we've seen some ebb and flow in the manufacturing scene in the Hoosier State. But you note that there was an increase, of growth. Tell us about that and the information and where you got it.
Yes, there was a new study released by Ball State University and Conexus Indiana, and they've, I want to qualify this with a caveat, though. They're talking about, there seems to be a little bit of confusion, they're talking about the manufacturing has grown 41% since 2000, and that's in productivity and output. And one thing that's really important is to separate that from actual employment, because employment in manufacturing around the country has plunged dramatically. We've lost millions of jobs since 2000, and that is largely as a result of automation. But just because the manufacturing sector is doing well and, you know, returning money to shareholders and so forth, that does not mean, you know, the manufacturing jobs are around or, you know, anymore. And, those are two entirely different things, and some people tend to confuse those, but those should entirely be separated. But it's found that, you know, manufacturing seems to be doing pretty well in Indiana, especially compared to neighboring states, because over that period it has declined in Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio, two of those which happen to be pretty much the largest manufacturing states in the country. But manufacturing has grown only 11% nationally since 2000, and relatively it's skyrocketed here. However, there are fewer factory jobs available. Manufacturing has been declining as an employer in the state. It's just companies are able to do more with less. As we've heard multiple times, like the steel mills, for instance, they're producing roughly as much steel as they did during the peak during the 70s, but it's no longer 30,000 people per mill. It's down to, you know, just a fraction of that in terms of employment. So manufacturing may be up, but the jobs are no longer, there to the degree that they had been.
Joseph Eats, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, with a number of stories on the business beat this week. Joseph, thank you very much for the info. We'll be checking back with you again real soon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Chris.
This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking. Time now to take a look at some stories out of Porter County in particular. Let's check in with Bob Casarda, who is a reporter working for the Times of Northwest Indiana out of the Valparaiso newsroom. And Bob, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
One of the interesting stories I know that you had on print as well as online is talking about some major improvements that have happened at the Porter County Jail that in turn have kind of, I guess, kept it maybe in one case, particular case, you started out talking about a potential lawsuit got averted. Tell us about the changes and how this is going to be much for the better for the Sheriff's Department.
The changes come after 15 years. Our jail here is 15 years old, and the camera system, the surveillance system in this building, has not been updated in that amount of time, at least not completely updated. There were some minor tweaks along the way, from what I understand. So they've put in a $1.3 million new system in this jail, which is key because the jail was built to have a lower amount of workforce in there by having an indirect type of contact and viewing of prisoners. So they rely heavily on this camera system. And the system they had, once again, was 15 years old, which the Sheriff David Reynolds had appropriately made the comment, could you imagine having the same cell phone for 15 years? That's how out-of-date things had become.
I know that in your article that was on available to see, I took a look at that and was looking through the article and found a description of what the pictures, the images on that old security system looked like. And it was rather interesting. I never realized you could get such a poor quality out of such a system here. I'm sure they probably were really concerned about that.
Well, yes, the sheriff actually had given an example. He said when there would be fights in the prisoners, I mean, a lot of the prisoners in the county jail here wear orange. And he says that when fights would break out, they'd see nothing really but a blur of orange going on. So it was very difficult, if not impossible, to detect afterwards who was even involved in a fight. And so each of the monitors, there's a station. It's interesting. It's almost like like you're in NASA or something when you go inside the jail. The control room is just a series of screens, and you can see these in the images with the story. Where the control room people sit and they watch all aspects of the jail, you know, outside, inside, nearly all, as we point out in this story, that the shower facilities and the actual individual cells are off limits to cameras, but everything else is covered. So they spend their days and in the evenings or overnight watching to keep an eye on things.
Yeah,
and the system is also real vital that it's not just the visual, it's not just the cameras, but the locking system for the doors and the intercom system is also all tied together in this. And there was a point that this aging system had actually collapsed for 3 days and it was down, so they were having to do a lot of this stuff manually during this 3-day period.
That probably made it very, very difficult for the jailers. You probably had to have extra jailers on hand on shifts to be able to keep an eye on guys that you normally would just be able to rely on the cameras and the microphones to do.
Well, yeah, it puts everybody a little more risk. I mean, the idea of having the fewer amount of staff in there and relying visually is that the jailers don't have to be out circulating as much with the inmates, mm-hmm. Which, of course, puts the jailers at much more risk.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that even though it is expensive, this got some benefits out of it here. I mean, there's when they began coming back, I guess, with your lead sentences in the story about the fact that there was an inmate who decided he was going to try and see if he can milk the system for all he could get, but the cameras kind of beat him to the punch. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a guy. The sheriff was sharing a story that they had somebody who claimed that they'd slipped and fell and injured their back or injured a part of their body, and they were going to sue over this.
Mm-hmm.
They just simply slipped and fell on a wet flooring, I believe, by a water fountain or something. Well, with the new system in place, they were able to run back the tapes. It's all digital now, but they were able to take a look at the tapes from that period and see that, indeed, this incident happened following the Super Bowl game where this inmate was particularly excited about a win and had was jumping up and around, actually went into his cell, tied some type of cape around his neck and slid across a table and thus showing that there was a lot more involved than just a simple fall because of the jail.
I'm sure that Sheriff Reynolds has been able to, in these discussions about this all with the county commissioners and the county council in particular, since they had to approve the money for this very expensive surveillance system, that they've probably shown that it's been worth all of the expense.
Yeah, each of the three commissioners I touch bases with who make decisions on this type of thing, they definitely felt that with the age of the building and the system that security issue. So you've got, the safety of the inmates, safety of the staff there, and then there's also the huge liability issue, with the jail, which came up in that example with the person threatening to sue.
Right.
So the county's covered all around. It's one of these things that as Commissioner Laura Blaney said, security at the jail isn't optional. It's one of these requirements for government.
We're talking with Bob Casarda, who is a reporter in Porter County for the Times of Northwest Indiana, working out of the Valparaiso newsroom. And one of the other stories, Bob, that you take and put up for us to see is concerns that one county commissioner has about the drug problem in Porter County being a big issue, but not sure exactly if it's being addressed properly. And he's not hearing very much, I guess, as far as whether it's in turn pay all the money and all the efforts are paying off. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that came up during the recent commissioner meeting. Members of the Substance Abuse Council showed up, and this is the group that manages money that's collected through the courts to combat local drug and alcohol efforts, anti-drug and alcohol efforts. And the group showed up, as they do each year, to report, you know, that they're going to be petitioning, you know, offering money available soon to different nonprofit and government groups to help. And Commissioner Biggs, who is back serving commissioner after being out for a few terms, mm-hmm. questioned the effectiveness of it, and pointed out that this group comes up each year, the money's approved, it goes off to all these efforts, but we're not seeing anything in return to verify that something's happening. I mean, obviously, Porter County's got this continued and appearance of a growing drug problem. So he's sent them back to the table to be able to show this year how this is working and have some more accountability with that money.
Does he, in turn, have to check back in as well, even though it's the county council that actually approves the money in Porter County, as always? But they have to go, I guess they'll have to get this organization to go back before the council as well, too? Or is it a case where this group is coming to the commissioners and the commissioners and then is asking for the additional funds if needed?
Well, this is a little unique thing financially, because while the money's collected by the courts, it actually funnels through the state, and the state is one who actually approves use of the funding and with subsequent approval by the county commissioner. So mm-hmm. they're very much in control of the money, and so they will be back. Like I said, I believe they said in August or so they'll be making the money available to its members, the Substance Abuse Council members who are pitching proposals and programs for this, and then the money will go out later this year. So the commissioners very much have their hands in on this money and deciding what's done. You know, they're just looking for some more accountability. This group of commissioners seem to be doing a lot more of that type of thing, you know, making sure that, you know, revamping things and making sure that things are being done the way they're supposed to be done.
Bob Casarda covers news in Porter County for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Bob, thanks for the updates on the stories here. We appreciate you taking time to tell us about them here, and we've got more coming up. We'll be back in touch with you soon. Thanks very much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Let's wrap things up now on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday with Stephen Lattimore, who's our reporter for the Time, covering the stories here in Northwest Indiana for Lakeshore Public Radio. Stephen, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
One of the big stories, in fact, just had as of yesterday, it was the news of a campaign that's going to get underway here in July to try to crack down on illegal dumping in the city of Gary.
It's a big problem. All you need to do is drive around, and you can see a lot of things that have been dumped. And so the mayor is starting a 90-day campaign, and the name of the campaign is All Eyes Are On You. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this is that she's going to actually be using cameras to monitor certain areas of the city to catch dumpers. Which is interesting. I know they use it in different places for shootings. And I mean, if you got them, use them, because
right.
They can't be everywhere, but they certainly can be covering more ground with those cameras. But in addition to that, she's also going to be monitoring very closely the repair shops, because they have a big problem with tires that are dumped in Gary a lot. And she actually mentioned, you know, you go to a place and you get a tire repaired, you actually are paying a fee for that.
Oh, yeah, that's
for disposal.
It's a state-mandated fee, too. It's not a local fee. It's a state-mandated environmental fee that you have to pay for whenever you have any of your work done on tires or the like.
And then she's finding that a lot of those tires still end up in the streets of Gary.
Yeah.
You know, so she says she's going to be monitoring those to make sure that they are, you know, linking those tires to those facilities. It's also interesting, too, she said that in a number of cases, and these, you know, you don't expect criminals to be bright, and usually they aren't, they dump stuff, and they have information with their addresses in the dumped material.
Yeah, that's right.
What kind of crime is that? Why don't you leave breadcrumbs while you're at it?
Well, the idea of having somebody on camera in case of illegal dumping is not unusual here. We know that the Lake County Solid Waste Management District has had problems at their recycling drop-off spots. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's why the one long-established one in Merrillville by the now-closed Strack and Van Til store on on Taft Street is closed and completely cleaned up and moved out to another location is because of the dumping problems there. So the county has problems as well with this. So it's not surprising that they put the cameras up about this.
Yeah. So this is going to be part of a big campaign that they use to try and curb the dumping.
We only have about a minute left here, Stephen. Let's talk, if we will, about one of the stories that you worked on in particular. Sorry about the Valparaiso Law School dean is had, I guess, involved in an anti-death penalty campaign. Tell us about that.
Yeah, back when Governor George Ryan was deciding that he was going to do away with capital punishment, Andrea Lyon was a lawyer who was very integral in sort of turning the tide there. She actually had a gentleman who she saved his life because she took up his case, investigated, and was able to show that, in fact, this person wasn't guilty at all. And, of course, as anybody who recalls, at that time, George Ryan decided, you know what, there's too much gray area here. I don't want to risk sending the wrong person to death because I found out later that there may have been prosecutorial misconduct or that a person didn't get a DNA test. And found out later that this guy was innocent, and I sent him to the death chamber. So this woman, this professor who is the dean of the law school in Valpo, was very integral in that. And for that, she got a Legal Legends Award from the American Constitution Society, the Chicago chapter.
Well, congratulations to her. We've been talking with Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio, and our thanks as well to him, as well as to John Gard, to Dan Carton, to Joseph Pete and Bob Casarda, all from the Times of Northwest Indiana, for being with us on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm Chris Nolte, back with you on Monday.